space to argue sort of under there. So this book for this evening, Frank Lloyd Wright in New York, The Plaza Years, 1954 to 59, the last 5 years of his life, is really a stroke of genius to take this as a topic on Frank Lloyd Wright. For as many books, as many shelves, as many libraries have been filled with Frank Lloyd Wright books, this is really the first that really focuses on this period and in our city of celebrity. And this is a city of celebrities, and it's a city of journalism, too, I think. And that the introduction to this book was written by Mike Wallace. And Deborah had a book before that, A Walk Tour of Turtle Bay, which was introduced by Walter Cronkite in the book. So with these kind of connections to the media, the projection of image, of history, of celebrity in New York, and what architect by witness of this evening is more of a celebrity than Frank Lloyd Wright, who defines celebrity for architecture. He was, by his own definition, the first architect of architects, although with Le Corbusier and Yves Saint Laurent, he had some petty competition. But this book takes New York and Frank Lloyd Wright as the subject, and it's extraordinarily beautifully done. I just wanted to point to a page that struck me as a great overview image of the conditions of New York. This one with the UN Secretariat in the foreground and the Empire State Building dominating the landscape of Midtown. To mark the two eras of New York's architecture, of the great setback style and the rise of the city in the 1920s, and then the displacement of those aesthetics by modernism, and a modernism that sort of passed and left out Frank Lloyd Wright in those intervening years. So everything in this book, in terms of the writing and especially the photographs, and I'm pledging you to buy a book that we have around the corner here before you leave, is beautifully done. And to that end, it won the 2008 Independent Publishers Book Award, the gold medal in architecture just last year. So many other people were well impressed by this book. And these writers, Jane King Ketchum and Deborah Pickrell, have both lived in New York and don't live in New York now, but I'm not still at Thunder because as journalists you need your lead line at every story. But they sort of switch places, the people who lived in New York and wrote about New York, and that kind of sort of, love and possession of the city is something that definitely comes through in their understanding of Wright's years here. But Jane is an architectural historian. She's also trained as an architect at the University of Minnesota, where she received her MArch. She's also the author of a book that I own, as a matter of fact, Ralph Rasmussen, 60 Years of Modern Design. That Midwestern connection and the expression of modernism through Rasmussen's career is really beautifully laid out in that book and all his various phases. Deborah Pickrell is a journalist who has written for Architectural Record and Metropolis and House Beautiful, as well as other magazines. She, as I mentioned, did a walking tour guide of Turtle Bay, over day in Turtle Bay. And she is formerly a board member of the Frank Lloyd Wright Conservancy, trained as a journalist at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, with also a master's in historic preservation from Goucher College. So with those credentials, they came to the study of this awesome monument and served a little historic preservation, I guess, in the process. Obviously, we're in a year of Wright with the Guggenheim and that exhibition, an extraordinary exhibition. And in the celebration, a perennial celebration of his genius, but really brought home so much by the span of work and drawings and projects in the retrospective of the Guggenheim, which I hope you've all seen. So with that, I give you Jane and Deborah.
Especially to those of you who are standing. With that in mind, I'm going to get right to it. During the last 5 years of his life, Frank Lloyd Wright was a New Yorker His address was the Plaza of Fifth Avenue in Central Park South. From his rarefied perch, Wright had a bird's eye view of New York's most elegant avenue and a picture window on the seasonal splendors of its most magnificent park. At the Plaza, he held court with the press, entertained the rich, famous, and powerful, negotiated with clients, and retreated with family. What was unusual about this was that Wright professed to hate all cities, and in general, and New York in particular, calling it a voracious mouth and comparing its buildings to cruel rat traps, and the city itself to a fibrous tumor. He was relentless in his criticism, and by 1954, his antipathy to Manhattan was crystal clear. But he was equally clear about his love for the Plaza Hotel, which he called the only beautiful hotel in this god-awful New York. Despite his protestations, he visited New York regularly and enjoyed strolling midtown streets with friends, dining at 21 or other fine Manhattan restaurants, visiting Asian art galleries, and attending the theater. And as the late New York Times architecture critic Herbert Mouchamp observed, there was a discrepancy between the tenor of Wright's remarks and the frequency of his New York jaunts. When it came to New York, Wright's words were one thing, but his actions were quite another. Tonight we will speak of a time when one of the world's greatest architects and one of the world's greatest cities came together, coexisted, and clashed for one brief five-year moment. In the years following World War II, America assumed world superpower status, and New York became its preeminent metropolis. Building was booming in Manhattan. More than 50% of the country's licensed architects were practicing here, and the leading architectural journals were published in New York as well. Consumerism was also on the rise, reflecting new prosperity and optimism. The baby boom was launched, and Americans bought cars, homes, and furniture. New York was the epicenter of the consumer explosion, and Madison Avenue became its advertising hub. Long the center of the radio and publishing industries in America, in the late 1940s and 50s, New York became the nation's television capital as well, ushering in the medium's golden age. As art critic Jed Pearl observed, New York was also a world city of art and was home to abstract expressionism, the first internationally recognized American art movement. Galleries, studios, and museums thrived. But for as much as the city was changing, one truth was immutable. It remained the ultimate proving ground for aspirants of all kinds. As the end of his life approached, and he had not one single building standing in Manhattan's skyline, Wright was one such aspirant, irresistibly drawn to New York and resolved to leave his lasting architectural mark on it. The Plaza was one of the grandest hotels in the city of grand hotels. Designed in the Chateauesque style by Henry Janeway Hardenberg, it was conceived as a lavish pleasure palace, and it quickly became New York's prominent address for visitors and residents alike. And when it opened in 1907, Mr. and Mrs. Alfred Wynne Vanderbilt were the first to sign the guest register. Directly in front of the 800-room hotel was, on the Fifth Avenue side, was a public plaza featuring the Pulitzer Fountain and a statue of General Sherman, originally cast for the Paris Exposition of 1900. Immediately to the south of the hotel was the palatial mansion of Cornelius Vanderbilt II. And this was demolished in 1927, and Bergdorf Goodman now stands in its place. The hotel had many renowned guests, including F. Scott Fitzgerald and his wife Zelda, who took dips in the Pulitzer Fountain, Greta Garbo, and the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, who danced the nights away in the plaza's glamorous night spots. And one very famous fictional residence, Eloise, whose spirited adventures in the elegant hotel popularized the plaza with a new generation of visitors, and her portrait still hangs in the hotel near the Palm Court. For decades, the plaza, which enjoyed an enviable location on the southeast corner of Central Park, had been Wright's hotel of choice whenever he traveled to New York on business. "I've been coming to the plaza for 40 years," he announced in a 1952 interview in The New Yorker. Surprisingly, Wright, an outspoken critic of nearly all architecture that was not of his own design, admired the hotel. He said, "Good old Henry Hardenberg, of course I wouldn't do anything like it, but it's an honest building." Hardenberg also figured in Bright's colorful version of the hotel's history. He said, "It was built by the Astors, the Asterisks, the Asterites, the Vanderbilts, the Plasterbilts, the Whoeverbilts, who wanted a place to dress up and parade in front of great mirrors. They sent for the finest master of the German Renaissance style, Henry Hardenberg, and he did this." By 1954, the hotel had become a comfortable habit for Wright, a home away from home for his personal and professional East Coast encounters. He often arranged meetings with the same familiar phrase, "We will be in New York, at the usual place, the Plaza." But beginning in 1943, Wright's visits to New York became more frequent. That year, he received a letter from Baroness Hilary Bay, who asked, "Could you ever come to New York and discuss with me a building for our collection of non-objective art?" Philanthropist Solomon R. Guggenheim owned the collection in question, and the building would become of the New York Museum that bears his name. Wright and his wife, Olga Vanna, were frequent guests in the Guggenheim's luxurious art-filled Plaza suite, which was located directly below the ones that the Wrights would inhabit later. By 1954, the Guggenheim project was moving forward, and Wright, who was nearing his 90s, was in need of a permanent home and office in the city from which he could supervise the complicated construction process of the building. The Plaza, which stood 30 blocks south of the Guggenheim's building site on Fifth Avenue between 88th and 89th, was perfect for his needs. Characteristically, Wright chose one of the hotel's most coveted corner apartments as his home and office, and there were few finer views of New York than the one from Suite 223-225, and it's highlighted here. The suite had an interesting history. Reputedly, Diamond Jim Brady, a New York financier with a prodigious appetite and a penchant for jewels, once lived in the suite, and Wright often referred to his redecoration of the suite as Diamond Jim Brady Modern. In the late 1940s, during Conrad Hilton's ownership of the hotel, the suite was decorated by French couturier Christian Dior for a time, and it was inhabited by David O. Selznick and his wife, actress Jennifer Jones. Wright began to redecorate the suite in the spring of 1954, and although he would have to work within an existing architectural framework, he would make the space his own. The suite, which was entered through a vestibule off a hotel corridor, comprised a corner living room with a north and east exposure, east-facing office and sleeping space, a hallway, bathroom, and pantry, and two fireplaces and six tall windows further defined the space. In an elevation of the living room wall, Wright noted annotated gold wall finish, and he conceived also the round beveled mirrors that would fit in the tall arched windows. Behind each mirror, he concealed lighting, the uplift lit effect of which he indicates in the drawing here. Now, at first glance, the rooms are somewhat surprising as a Wright space, and in fact, there are many non-Wrightian elements, including 13.5-foot high ceilings, decorative crown molding, and a crystal chandelier, all of which Wright had to honor as existing features of the hotel. However, closer examination reveals Wright's aesthetic preferences and design control. Wall surfaces were covered with Japanese rice paper flecked with gold leaf and set off in gilt frames. Shutters and trim were painted a rose color. Floor-to-ceiling curtains were a deep purple red. Wall-to-wall carpeting was peach, and as were the velvet upholstered chairs. Characteristically, Wright, a music lover, found a prominent space in the hotel suite for his grand piano. And true to form, he adorned the spaces with treasured art objects, and he delighted from their daily use. Here's just a comparison of that same corner of the suite. Wright designed numerous pieces of furniture for the suite, including his desk, a dozen three-legged stools, several tables, and an easel. Taliesin Apprentices built the simple plywood furniture in Wisconsin, and a black lacquer finish was applied at a local auto body shop. Exposed edges were finished in Chinese red. The office studio space was similarly furnished, but chairs, and these chairs date from the Christian Dior suite, were upholstered in a plum-colored velvet. A long easel was designed and made by Wright, and it held renderings of various projects and a large oil painting, Pelvis with Shadows and the Moon, a gift from Georgia O'Keeffe, who was a friend and a fellow Wisconsinite. In this room, Wright surrounded himself with telling objects, Asian art and artifacts from his large collection, fresh flowers, a set of Sweet's architectural catalogs, and a photo of his mother. Wright utilized the folding screen you see at the left to create a narrow sleeping area. The suite, which familiarly became known as Taliesin III, was captured in black and white by noted architectural photographer Ezra Stoller, whose work you see here. Pedro Barrero, Wright's personal photographer, took the only known color images of the suite, and those were the ones you were looking at a moment ago. While there's no question that both photographers captured the beauty and of the suite in serene moments, they could not capture the bedlam of activity that defined life in this in the home and busy office. According to one suite visitor, there was pandemonium going on all the time. Many celebrities visited the Wrights in the suite, including Wright's granddaughter, award-winning actress Anne Baxter, and Pulitzer Prize-winning poet and biographer Carl Sandburg, who was an old friend of Wright from his Oak Park years. The suite was also the subject, the site of many radio and television interviews, and on one occasion served as a recording studio. This album, Frank Lloyd Wright on Record by Cal Cadman, was recorded in the suite. The plaza's splendid public rooms and numerous amenities proffered many advantages for the Wrights, who often entertained guests in the Palm Court. But his favorite space was the Oak Room, dubbed a German Renaissance tour de force by former plaza historian Curtis Gagey. For decades, Wright conducted interviews there with journalists, including New Yorker writers Lewis Mumford and Brendan Gill. Over a meal or his favorite libation, Old Bushmills Meat, a relaxed Wright would expound on whatever was on his mind, and his opinions would often appear in the next issue of the magazine. Although he was comfortably ensconced at the plaza and enjoyed expansive views from his elegant suite, Wright did not like everything he saw in New York. The burgeoning skyline was increasingly populated by the sleek glass and steel buildings of the international style, designed by the glass box boys, as Wright flippantly termed their designers. Wright, an organic architect who believed in intrinsic form and function, abhorred these buildings. And the fact that he had never built an urban tower after a lifetime of designing only compounded his ire.
Can we go back a slide? Park Avenue was the new concourse of American commerce, the showplace of the international style. Ushered in by Art Deco and streamlined modern before it, these buildings were the sparkling representations of the nation's post-war power. Wright, however, took a different view. A box is more a coffin for the human spirit than an inspiration, he said. He believed these standardized buildings contributed to urban congestion and showed complete disregard for their sites, not to mention the indignation he felt for their architects. Though his prescient work had actually influenced the group decades earlier, he now found that they were his competition. Though certainly popular, the buildings had other detractors as well. While acknowledging Park Avenue's, quote, dramatic revolution, young New York Times architecture critic Ada Louise Huxtable also labeled most of its structures as stark glass boxes, shocking and strange, creating monotony and uniformity, reserving praise solely for Lieber House and the Seagram Building. The 1952 Lieber House, designed by Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill's Gordon Bunshaft, was the city's first all-glass curtain wall skyscraper, a built realization of the earlier imaginings of Mies van der Rohe and Le Corbusier. While the cutting-edge building wowed Manhattanites, Wright dubbed it the soap building and a box on sticks. 6 years later, Mies's iconic Seagram Building rose diagonally across the avenue. The first bronze-clad curtain wall structure, it was designed in partnership with Philip Johnson and in association with Kahn and Jacobs. Wright, who assailed Mies' less is more philosophy, but believed him to be more of an individualist than his European contemporaries, was a bit kinder to the whiskey building, as he called it, terming it the best of its kind. Wright, recognized as one of the world's greatest architects, was not asked to design for the city's new corporate corridor. Never one for committees, he said. Architecture has never come out of collaboration alive. And he was rejected among design candidates for the Seagram Building because of his mercurial temperament. Additionally, some felt that both he and his intricate individualized designs were past their prime. The root of Wright's intense objections to the towers rising around him were established many years earlier when he formulated his own dynamic ideas for building tall, which he demonstrated here for photographer Pete Guerrero at the Plaza Hotel. While a proponent of modern materials and the machines used to shape them, Wright advocated what he called plasticity, the total absence of constructed effects, as evident in the result, flowing or growing into form instead of built up out of cut and joined pieces, as you see on the left. He claimed that international-style buildings represented a return to the constrained post-Convene construction of the 19th century. Call it modern, but don't call it new, he told a CBS television reporter during a hansom cab interview along Park Avenue. Wright's concept of plasticity evolved to become one of continuity, form and function as intrinsic and symbiotic elements of a building, as he shows on the right. We want them together. We want the poetry of the thing, he said, deeply committed to the individuality and spirituality he believed inherent to his craft and absent in the city's cookie-cutter glass boxes. Wright received the first two tower commissions of his practice in the 1920s. 1924 brought the National Life Insurance Company project, an early glass curtain wall structure for a Chicago client. Featuring Wright's novel taproot structural system in which floors or limbs were cantilevered from a central steel and concrete core or trunk, the building was to be sheathed in iridescent sheets of copper and glass with adjustable windows and screens to control ventilation and glare. The conservative client abandoned the project and the building was not constructed. In 1927, New York clergyman William Guthrie, rector of the city St. Mark's in the Bowery, wrote to Wright, his longtime friend, requesting a design for an apartment tower to generate rental income for his church. Wright responded by designing three 18-story edifices for the site's park-like environment and another for a lot to the south across the street. Conceived in prismatic rather than rectilinear form, the unusual buildings were designed with light, space, and privacy in mind. Praised on several levels by architectural record, the Times dubbed the towers odd type buildings in an October 19, 1929 announcement of their plans. 10 days later, as we know, the stock market crashed, and Guthrie and his vestry members became increasingly skittish about Wright's unusual, unproven design. Though shelved in May 1930, the project's taproot plan would provide the model for the architect's freestanding tall buildings to come. Some 20 years later, Wright's taproot scheme finally came to light in a Midwestern factory town. The 14-story 1950 Johnson Research Tower of Racine, Wisconsin was constructed adjacent to the company's Wright-designed 1936 administration building. It featured alternating mezzanine floors that seemed to float within it. In 1953, a second Wright Tower, the tallest of his designs ever erected, began to rise in another unlikely location, Bartlesville, Oklahoma. The 19-story Price Tower for oil pipeline mogul Carroll C. Price Sr. was adapted from the St. Mark's design, reduced in scale, and revised to accommodate business and residential spaces. Like St. Mark's, the tower was sited to best capture light, with copper louvers to control natural illumination, reduce the use of air conditioning, and add lively dimension to its appearance. The tree that escaped the forest, as Wright termed the building, demonstrated a key aspect of his 1930s Broadacre City plan, shown here in an illustration from his 1958 book, The Living City. The plan promoted the idea of tall towers in open spaces as part of self-sufficient, decentralized communities. Promoting an alternative to dense urban living, Broadacre, in some ways, mirrored the nation's advancing suburbanization and forecast its mid-century sprawl. The offices and double-decked apartments of the Price Tower were conceived on an intricate pinwheel plan. This plan, Wright said, permitted flexibility of arrangement not afforded by the rectangle. Park Avenue's tall towers contain standardized workspaces that typically deprive those below executive status of natural light and views, and mass-produced furnishings were the order of the day. It's a Mad Men set, no doubt. By contrast, the Price Tower's offices, which varied in size, proffered views across the prairie and natural ventilation options. All featured built-in Philippine mahogany desks and lightweight partitions that divided office areas. Though construction cost estimates ranged to over $2 million at the time, an amount exceeding $15 million today, Price Tower was remarkably unique. with the form intended to, quote, transcend function and be touched with poetic imagination, according to Architectural Forum. Yet, even as the Price Tower was completed, the majority of Wright's 12 tall tower designs still remained unbuilt. Despite any broadacre proselytizing to the contrary, he became determined to define the urban tower of the future, glass box boys be damned. The design for the Mile High Illinois, a colossal $60 million, 528-story taproot tower, resulted from a simple commission for a Chicago television antenna. His last gesture for a skyscraper, Wright said the Mile High represented the future of the tall building in the American city. Though unbuilt, author Donald Hoppin described it as a great space marker heralding the 21st century, a technology and culture yet to come. Indeed, some 50 years later, building tall is a global trend that continues to escalate. Around the same time as the Mile High design, popularity of the international style began to wane in New York, just as Wright predicted it would. Though he would not contribute a company tower to the city's architectural mix, he engaged in its commercial supremacy in other ways, including a showroom for foreign automobiles along the very corridor where the glass box boys were making their mark. Post-war New York was the epicenter of mid-century's happy-go-spending consumer frenzy, fueled by the rise of corporate industry and an economic boom. With suburban sprawl proliferating and shopping centers popping up in every community, the car became the most valued commodity in this new go-to-work and get-the-goods society. This is a shot of Macy's before the opening bell in the 1950s. Austrian immigrant Maximilian Hoffman became New York's leading importer of luxury automobiles at a time when consumer interest in them was just beginning. By 1953, Hoffman owned three successful showrooms in Manhattan, featuring vehicles such as Jaguars and Mercedes-Benz. As his business escalated, Hoffman began to hunt for an architect to design a residence for him outside the city. His friend Philip Johnson, whose designs Hoffman judged too austere, suggested Wright. The auto mogul and the architect got along well, sharing a mutual passion for hard work, blunt honesty, and the design of fine automobiles. In December 1953, with discussions about Hoffman's house shown here underway, Hoffman asked Wright to design a Jaguar showroom for 430 Park Avenue at 56th Street. Though Wright objected to the modern building that would contain it, a commission for a wealthy client in the hub of the city's architectural action was too good to pass up. The 1954 Hoffman Automobile Showroom was Wright's first permanent work in the city and one of his very few interior-only projects. The showroom boasted gleaming floor-to-ceiling windows and mirrored interior walls. Its central feature was a combination of rotating turntable and spiral lamp on which six automobiles could be displayed. A signature element of several Wright designs, the spiral would be used most famously in the Guggenheim Museum to come. Though tantalizing, the expensive automobiles featured in Hoffman's showroom were largely out of reach for America's burgeoning middle class, for whom affordability was a key consideration. Continually interested in spreading his democratic ideas for modern living, Wright had an influential ally in this quest. Elizabeth Gordon, editor of House Beautiful magazine, headquartered in New York. Gordon viewed her magazine as a propaganda and teaching tool and believed Wright to be the greatest architect alive. The two shared an intense dislike of the international style as well. Gordon began to cover Wright's work in 1946, and the two forged a close partnership. Gordon and her staff visited Taliesin several times. John DeCoven Hill, pictured at Wright, was a former Taliesin apprentice who would become, at Wright's suggestion, the architectural editor of House Beautiful when James Marston Fitch left to join Columbia University's faculty. In an effort to further popularize Wright with the American public, Gordon was instrumental in conceiving the Taliesin Ensemble, lines of mass-produced home furnishing products designed by Wright and heavily promoted by the editor in her magazine. Though Wright had publicly assailed interior decorators as inferior desecrators more than once, and then outright disagreed with the use of several of the proposed products, such as paint, that would cover the natural beauty of wood, the potential monetary reward of the lines, plus the opportunity to expose a broad sector of the public to his ideas in familiar forms, sealed the arrangement. The Taliesin Ensemble was introduced in the November 1955 issue of House Beautiful, one of two issues that Gordon would devote entirely to the architect. A major feature announced, and now Frank Lloyd Wright designs that you can buy. They included a furniture line by Heritage Hendradon available at several New York department stores, including B. Altman, Bloomingdale's, and Abraham Strauss. Fabrics and wall coverings by F. Schumacher and Company. And a line of paints by Martin Senor, including colors such as Spring Green and Cherokee Red, Wright's favorite hue. Despite splashy introductions to the press, decorators, and the public in Chicago and New York, as well as heavy editorial and advertising promotion in House Beautiful, only the Schumacher line proved successful in the long run. In fact, it was the company's longest running license. On several occasions, products from the line were employed in houses of Wright's own design, including the 1959 Cass House on Staten Island, which featured Schumacher draperies in a public open house. An example of the architect's 1956 prefabricated housing program, the Cass House was one of only 11 of Wright's prefab houses ever built and his sole New York City residential commission. While less than successful in garnering new architecture commissions in mid-century New York or in the sale of most of his consumer product lines, Wright was more effective in promoting his most unique and valuable commodity, himself.
Frank Lloyd Wright was outrageous, fabulously quotable, and in constant demand by the media. And in a city that attracted a high quotient of glittering personalities, in the day, Frank Lloyd Wright was a bona fide celebrity. He attracted several famous clients during his years in New York, many of whom he entertained in his sumptuous plaza quarters. Among the most illustrious were Marilyn Monroe and her new husband, playwright Arthur Miller. In his autobiography, Miller claimed it was Monroe's idea to contact Wright to design their dream home. And in fact, her path had tangentially crossed with Wright's before, twice. In 1950, she appeared in the film All About Eve with Wright's granddaughter, actress Anne Baxter. And in 1953, she honeymooned with her then-husband, Joe DiMaggio, in the Imperial Hotel in Tokyo. And if you look very closely up in the balcony, you can see Marilyn waving and Joe DiMaggio standing sulkily to the side. Next, please. Monroe came to Wright's Plaza apartment more than once, and each time a flabbergasted apprentice greeted her at the door because Wright rarely announced her appointments. Wright whisked the actress into his office and banned all others from the room. He dispatched his apprentices on errands and he sent his wife out shopping. As one observer noted, Wright just wanted to have any beautiful woman to himself. The Millers wanted to build a house on their farmland in rural Roxbury, Connecticut, and in 1957, Wright accompanied the couple to the property. Once on site, Miller explained that he and Monroe did not want some elaborate home with which to impress the world, but rather one that reflected their desire to live simply. Later, Miller recalled that this news had not the slightest interest for Wright. Of the existing farmhouse, Wright said, "Don't put a nickel into it." The scheme which Wright proposed was neither simple nor new. In fact, it was a reinterpretation of two recent unbuilt designs, one planned for Fort Worth, Texas, and the other for Acapulco, Mexico. The proposed design featured a large house with a circular living room 60 feet in diameter, complete with a projection booth, retractable movie screen, and a massive chandelier. Two wings, which angled off the main space, contained a conservatory, library, card room, guest, servant, and chauffeur's quarters, in addition to basic living spaces. The house was to be built of local fieldstone and roofed with a thin concrete dome that was sheathed in gold aluminum. Wright also proposed a swimming pool supported by a massive retaining wall, which you can see the triangular section to the left, that Miller feared would require heavy construction along the lines of the Maginot Line to achieve. Upon viewing Wright's watercolor fantasy, Miller immediately deemed the plans inappropriate for their lifestyle and rustic site. He objected to the ostentatious scheme, and he feared that the pool alone would consume the projected budget of $250,000. Citing costs, the Millers abandoned the project. In 1958, the couple's marriage was crumbling. They divorced in 1961, and in 1962, Marilyn Monroe died of an overdose. So sadly, there would be no dream home for the Millers by Wright or anyone else. Wright's marketability and draw as a celebrity led to a 1957 collaboration with theater impresario Mike Todd, industrialist Henry J. Kaiser, and former NBC president Pat Weaver, Sylvester Weaver, who's also Sigourney Weaver's father. At the time, Todd was an Academy Award-winning producer of the movie Around the World in 80 Days, husband of Elizabeth Taylor, and pioneer of the groundbreaking widescreen film projection system called Todd AO. He had hit upon the idea of showing his films in a chain of Todd AO theaters located in America's new shopping centers where there would be plentiful parking. Kaiser, who had recently built an aluminum dome theater in Hawaii based on Buckminster Fuller's geodesic dome, became a partner in the project. Todd planned to adapt the dome for his mass market use and to revolutionize the theater business in the process. Brilliant structural innovator though he was, Fuller was not a household name. And sensing the project's marketing potential, Todd, Kaiser, and Weaver wanted a high-profile architect known to the American public to design the project. Citing his flamboyance and ability to attract attention, they selected Wright. Wright was contracted to design the understructure of the dome, but characteristically, he expanded his commission. He proposed precast concrete shells to support the dome, and he redesigned the dome itself with a gentler curve. Oops, back one, please. The four men held their only face-to-face meeting in Wright's Plaza suite. By January of 1958, Wright had prepared drawings that he suggested had many virtues. Comparing them to Todd's stunning wife, Wright wrote, "Love to Elizabeth, but the new Michael Todd Theater is almost as beautiful and will last longer." He did have a way with words, didn't he? Todd said he would stop in Phoenix to review the drawings on his next trip to the West Coast. Tragically, he never did see the drawings. 2 weeks later, Todd perished when his private plane, the Liz, crashed in New Mexico. And although the remaining partners tried to carry on, in truth, any hopes of realizing the Mike Todd Theater died along with its colorful conjurer. Yet, as Todd had predicted, the concept of building movie theaters in shopping malls became ubiquitous and did indeed revolutionize the theater business in the process. William Zeckendorf was a celebrity of a different sort. Described as an oversized bulldog of a man and a caricature of the jowly, big-bellied real estate operator, he was wealthy and powerful New York real estate tycoon, and he was the man who put the land deal together for the United Nations project. Wright Zeckendorf's first meeting was in a televised debate on NBC's American Forum of the Air, where they battled out the future of the American city, with Wright arguing for its obsolescence, and Zeckendorf promoting its revitalization via urban renewal. Publicly, Wright hurled all kinds of insults at the tycoon and coined the word Zeckendorfs as a derogatory term for big city developers. But thanks to Zeckendorf's generous and forgiving nature, privately the two men enjoyed a warm friendship. And although they never built a project together, preliminary plans were developed for a motor hotel and a 25-acre plot of land in New York. Next, please. Most significantly, Zeckendorf, who had many interests in Chicago, saved the Roby House, Wright's Prairie School masterpiece, by purchasing it for $125,000 when its owner, the Chicago Theological Seminary, wanted to demolish it in 1957 to make room for a dorm. A grateful Wright designed a plaque for the house that read, "Safe from Destruction by William Zeckendorf, American Builder." Certainly the highest compliment he ever paid to a realtor. We each have favorite photos in this book, and this is one of mine. It's a photograph of people watching television in Rockefeller Center, and what's on the screen is the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II in 1953. In the 1950s, the vast majority of America's TV shows were televised from New York studios, and Wright was able to enhance his celebrity and extend his promotional reach through this popular new medium. Wright and television were perfectly suited for each other. Although in the 1950s, Wright was an elderly man and television was a young industry, both were brash, bold purveyors of experimental ideas. First, appearing in London on the BBC in 1939, Wright was a born proselytizer, and he proved himself to be a natural on the small screen. One of his earliest nationally televised appearances was on NBC's Conversations with Elder Wiseman, which aired on May 17, 1953. The show, which was the brainchild of Sylvester Weaver, strove to showcase the world's greatest thinkers. And the series was hosted by a 32-year-old, Hugh Downs, who is seen here in a very low chair. Famously, during the interview, Wright said, "Early in life, I had to choose between honest arrogance and hypocritical humility. I chose arrogance, and I see no reason to change." Downs later recalled two things about the man. He did not waste a lot of effort on the lubrication of tact, and he was a genius, no doubt about it. That same week, Wright appeared on the Today Show, hosted by Dave Garraway. During the interview, he prophesied about many things, including his prediction that the city would move to the country and grass would be growing in the streets of New York in 25 years. But he also demonstrated a remarkable grasp for the then black and white medium of television. Following Garraway's effusive introduction of the architect, Wright interjected and he said, "Don't make me blush, please, because you wouldn't get the color on television." June 3rd, 1956, Mark was what was undoubtedly his most surprising television appearance on everybody's famous favorite guessing game, What's My Line on CBS. When asked to enter and sign in, please, an elegant Wright took his time crafting his famous signature, and to further identify the man, the words "world famous architect" were superimposed on the screen. The masked panel, and this is not the panel that night, but this is what they would have looked like. His panel was Arlene Francis, Paul Winchell, Dorothy Kilgallen, and Peter Lawford, strove to reveal the mystery guest identity through questioning. Ultimately, Wright gave himself away. He could not hear the questions, and he noted, "The sound goes out, but it doesn't come back." Host John Daly quickly said, "Oh, don't worry about that. We have a bit of an acoustics problem here." And Wright said, "Yes, you do." With that, Dorothy Kilgallen identified Wright. As he exited, he complimented the panel on their extraordinary intelligence and told them about his new Price Tower that was rising on the Oklahoma prairie. But Wright wasn't the only celebrity appearing that evening. Liberace, the flamboyant pianist, was another mystery guest. Undoubtedly, Wright's most famous and provocative television appearance was on the September 1957 Mike Wallace interview on ABC. A cutting-edge show that asked penetrating questions. It was unrehearsed, uncensored, unedited. There were no ground rules, and questions were not provided in advance. Wallace asked Wright to be on the show because he said he was a stormy petrel, an object of great admiration, and he had a richly original mind. Wallace was 39, and Wright was 90. The show began when a smoke-veiled Wallace saying, "I'm Mike Wallace and the cigarette is Philip Morris," plugging the program's sponsor. The interview covered a range of topics, including organic architecture, modern art, Charlie Chaplin, democracy, and sex. Wallace baited and Wright coolly responded. At one point, Wallace turned the tables on his host. Wright turned the table on his host. He said, "Do you ever feel like apologizing for that thing in your hand?" Pointing to the sponsor's cigarette. Wallace quickly responded, "No, not at all. I enjoy it," but later recalled it was a very awkward moment. However, Wright quickly retreated, saying, "Let's leave the cigarette smoker his salts." Of the thousands of people he encountered during his decades as a television journalist, Wallace cites Wright as one of the most fascinating individuals he ever interviewed. And according to Wallace, the only person who matched him in supreme confidence and assurance was the Ayatollah Khomeini. As Wright stood his architectural ground with the press and his competitors and showcased his architectural wares in New York department stores and hobnobbed with celebrities, his main purpose for establishing a residence in the city, the Guggenheim, slowly began to rise uptown, a spiral museum that would represent not only Manhattan, his only Manhattan structure, but would also represent the culmination of his career.
As Wright moved into his Plaza suite, construction on the Guggenheim was on hold. Waiting for the architect to secure the necessary building permits, such obstacles had become commonplace, and many years had passed since his 1943 commission for the project, the first model for which is shown in this 1945 photograph. The reasons for the delays were numerous, including Guggenheim's belief that construction costs would drop following the war, his death in 1949, Rebay's dismissal in 1952, the appointment of a trying new curator and director, James Johnson Sweeney, and questions about the museum's suitability to the architectural landscape of Fifth Avenue and the Upper East Side. 1953 saw a placeholder on the museum site, 60 years of living architecture, an exhibit of 800 Wright drawings and artifacts housed in a pavilion of the architect's design, along with the complementary Usonian Exhibition House, a full-scale demonstration of Wright's affordable Usonian house building program. The exhibition was the largest to date devoted to one man, attracting 30,000 visitors in 52 days. The full story of the realization of the Guggenheim, all 16 years of it, is a long, convoluted, and complicated saga that I will not relay to you here. But I do want to relay some New York highlights about it. In his prolonged struggle to realize the museum, Wright had a few key allies, New York power brokers all. First and foremost was Harry Guggenheim, shown here with his wife, Alicia Patterson. Guggenheim, who became the chair of the Guggenheim Foundation's Board of Trustees upon his uncle Solomon's death, was an unlikely successor. Not an art connoisseur or a patron, he was a man of wealth and diverse talents. A staunch Republican, ambassador to Cuba, early promoter of America's aviation industry, and owner of thoroughbred racehorses. Even so, he was determined to see his uncle's dream realized. Without Guggenheim's dedication and his astute aptitude for diplomacy and negotiation, the museum may not have been realized. He had a warm yet challenging relationship with Wright, once writing, "Querido Francisco," the affectionate term he used for Wright, "who tries me sorely, but for whom I have great affection." Guggenheim's wife, Alicia, was successful in her own right, and she used her clout as publisher of Long Island's Newsday to promote and support Wright and the museum project. Wright also had the support of his cousin by marriage, Robert Moses, the city's parks commissioner, among other titles, and believed by many to be the most powerful man in New York. In 1955, with the museum's construction on hold, the architect appealed to his powerful cousin Bob. No fan of modern architecture, Moses responded, "I don't personally like either the museum or what's going into it, but we'll help some good friends in a dubious enterprise because they are friends and not for any other reason." Help he did, cutting through bureaucratic red tape and issuing an ultimatum to the current building commissioner, "Damn it, get a permit for Frank. I don't care how many laws you have to break." The permit was issued in March 1956, and ground was finally broken on August 16th of that year. Wright was a frequent visitor to the Guggenheim site, supervising his assisting apprentices and the museum's complicated construction. He always brought his razor-sharp vision to bear in the process, able to see what others could not. When the building was merely a deep hole in the ground, he gestured with his cane to the sky and commented to his book publisher, Ben Rayburn, "A magnificent building, isn't it, Ben?" The museum was a structure about which New Yorkers and the world were intensely curious, and this is one of my favorite photographs. It's from the New York Times. Descriptors for the rising spiral abounded, including a beehive, a cupcake, a bobsled course, a giant jello mold, and an old-fashioned washing machine, but also ahead of its time. In September 1957, Wright toured the unfinished building with New York Times critic Aileen Saarinen, wife of Arrow, and discussed his snail-like structure with her, boldly stating, "Here in the Guggenheim, you will see 20th century arts and architecture in their true relation." But that point was debatable, particularly when it came to the opinion of director Sweeney. Imported for the job from the Museum of Modern Art and shown here with Wright at the 60 Years Exhibition. Wright was locked at odds with Sweeney for years over design issues and rising costs, as well as the architect's ideas about the proper display of art, about which the artistic community and the city itself also expressed skepticism. In the end, Sweeney was a victor on nearly all counts. On October 21st, 1959, the building that would make the Metropolitan Museum look like an outdated stone quarry, according to Wright, opened to the public. Sadly, Wright did not live to see the day. He died 6 months earlier, on April 17, 1959. Devotees, detractors, and the curious flocked to see the remarkable new showplace for non-objective art. And everyone had an opinion about the building, official or otherwise. Reactions ranged from shock, disapproval, to awed admiration, and questions were raised. Was it a monument or a museum? Was it about architecture or art? Times critic A. Louise Huxtable lauded its luminous, soaring space. The Herald Tribune called it the most beautiful building in America, but the AIA Journal criticized the building for being distinctly out of place. Perhaps harshest of all was the judgment of Wright's longtime friend and sometime critic, Louis Mumford, who took Wright's building to task for turning its back in Central Park, calling it the bitterest pill. But none of this commentary would have concerned Wright, who had once remarked to a colleague in regard to the museum, "They will still be trying to figure this one out in 1,000 years. The one fact about which there was no debate was that the building instantly became an iconic symbol of New York to its citizens and the world. Harry Guggenheim identified another important aspect of the building, the fact that Wright revolutionized the concept of what a museum was and could be by building, quote, an extraordinarily personal statement in the middle of a conformist city. A groundbreaking concept in 1959, the Guggenheim began the trend toward destination museums designed by high-profile architects that we know today, museums as art that are inextricably linked to their creators. Royer's Whitney Museum in 1966, Pei's East Building in the National Gallery in 1978, and perhaps most significantly, as you see here, Gary's Guggenheim Museum Bilbao from 1997. At the museum's opening day dedication, Moses reflected on his cousin. After some 90 years, his body wore out, but his mind was undiminished to the end, and his youthful crusading spirit will surely live. For no man of talent was ever less awed by his enemies or more certain of artistic resurrection. For much of his life, New York was an antagonist for Wright, and he remained a critic of it until the end. Yet during his last 5 years, he also called Manhattan home and unabashedly loved living at the Plaza Hotel. To be certain, Wright's relationship with the city was rich and complex, quixotic and mercurial, combative and conciliatory. In this context, it's fitting that his only freestanding building realized in Manhattan would not only be, quote, a bold and defiant personal statement, but also would become an enduring, instantly recognizable symbol of the city he loved to hate. After Wright's death, his wife Olga Vanna instructed John de Coven Hill to inventory the Plaza Suite's contents and then dismantle it. Although some effects remain in the collection of the Frank Lloyd Wright archives, many of the items were sold by Olga Vanna in the ensuing years. Wright left his suite for the last time on January 17, 1959, 50 years ago. In a 1957 interview with television journalist Alastair Cook, Wright said, "I consider myself a success only insofar as my life is useful, revealing, and rewarding to my kind. Who knows who is a success until long after the circumstances? Success is measured not in ordinary terms, but what will transpire 50 years later. So 50 years from now, you will know whether or not I'm a successful person." Thank you.
While they do that, I'm going to turn the HVAC on so we'll all cool off, so you'll have to shout. And as we get our bottle opener from upstairs and bring it back down, we'll get some wine ready for you so we'll have a little reception afterwards, and we invite you to buy a book as well. But let's have some questions in.
Just a quick, small one. Where did Hoffman have his home?
It's in Rye, New York.
It's in Rye.
Mm-hmm. Still there. Yes.
If my heart is still there, it was never built.
No, it was $60 million. Wright even knew it would not be built. It was just a great dream.
This one is in that one, yes.
You mentioned the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation, is it, or association, or something. Where is that located?
It's in Spotsdale.
So it's in Taliesin.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir, in the back. Would you shout, please?
What is the cost of, I guess, the major cost of Guggenheim Museum? When it costs the first viewers? Estimate.
Yeah,
estimate of the cost.
I think it was a million. I think it was 3 million.
letters between Hilda Rebay and Wright. They're quite fascinating. It took a long time. You can get there soon. They're wonderful. But I'm wondering, I have no doubt you've read them. Was there much of it that you referred to in your book? You talked about some of the trials and tribulations, finding the site, persuading one another to do it.
Well, we did read them all, and the correspondence with Harry. We referred to some of it, but again, the focus of this book was we tried to limit it to the 5-year period in New York. The Guggenheim was a 16-year project, and we had to make some choices there. So enough to set the story up and establish what the relationship was, but we couldn't have.
Am I correct that the original site chosen was not where it is now?
Correct. The separate site considered. Was Central Park considered as a site? There was a site actually near where the Ramona is right now. There was a site of kind of around the Oysters Riverdale. And there was another site that way downtown. Yes?
You mentioned building in Oklahoma, you wanted to keep air conditioning limited. What was his reason for that? Was it environmental?
Wright could not stand air conditioning. He said the inside gets colder and colder while the outside gets hotter and hotter. So I think it plays back to his concept of the natural environment in Portland, incorporating that as much as it is in his buildings. But you know, we could think about sustainability issues potentially related to that way. He wouldn't solve that.
It was just the natural effect of air conditioning.
Natural air was far preferable.
Yes.
How did you come to pick this period for your book?
The question is, how did we come to pick this period for our book? The way this began was actually, I gave a 20-minute talk at a conference on the Plaza, and it was a conference based in New York, and I grew up in the area, and I had always loved the Plaza, and it just seemed kind of like something that was very interesting. Never happened to be in the audience, and approached me about this, and said, I think this would be a great idea for a small book on the subject, and we collaborated. Deborah was living in New York and had an interest, as I did, in Wright, and that's, we like the idea too of a very focused topic, looking at just a few years, and also looking at television and a lot of things that were happening in New York, and we firmly believe that New York in the 1950s is a character in this book, as surely as Wright is a character in the book.
What you said about his dislike of air conditioning.
Well, it did not. She asked, does Taliesin West have any air conditioning in it, given Wright's dislike of air conditioning? Originally, it did not, but it is not. It's not a home any longer. It's a public museum, and it contains a lot of artifacts, so it is air conditioned. It is in part, but not originally. And also, the desert was a very different place when he built it. It was not. It was the desert. It was dry. I mean,
apartment 4 months
closed for many, many years. It's kind of ironic that a building built 20 years after the main building, which is still in use, is not in use. What happened to Hawaii, if you know?
The question is, why about the Johnson Wax Tower in Racine and the fact that it is closed and has been for some years, and the question is, why was that?
My last understanding, and there may have been further developments, is that there were some material issues, structural issues, there was a leaking in the building. Wright was not an engineer, first and foremost, so he was always pushing materials.
It was also designed for a specific company for a specific purpose, and has a rather limited floor plan, so it's a little bit difficult
but
to
understand. But they're still
there. They are there.
But it's dangerous to go into that.
But in terms of its use, how it might be used, it's not the way it's used right now. Any other questions? Yes?
Getting my wallets as part of your effort was, I'm sure, a terrific experience for you. I think he's such a great bridge in terms of getting into the intricate mind of Wright. First question, what was it like for you interviewing Mike Wallace? And two, if you didn't get Mike Wallace, who was he?
The question is about Mike Wallace and what the experience was like to get him for this book, and what it was like to interview him, and had you not gotten Mike Wallace, who was the second choice? I'll answer the last part first. There wasn't a second choice. it was interesting to get him. I think Deborah came up with the idea, and my cousin's neighbor knew someone who worked with him, and we managed to get a request to him, and he very, very graciously accepted very quickly. And we did interview him. It was kind of a mind-bending experience because, you go in there and you say, no, wait a minute, we're interviewing Mike Wallace? I mean, of all the people to interview, it just seems like an odd thing to do. He was gracious and helpful, had a wonderful memory. He was just a terrific person to work with, and we appreciate his contributions.
I was literally almost hyperventilating before I went to the interview. And Jane and I have really done our homework, but when you're sitting eye to eye with Mike Wallace, one of the most venerable journalists of all time, it's a really quite an experience. But he's very enthusiastic about the project and has remained so. So it was definitely on my top 10 list of life experiences.
That's right. It's about Wright's age now. It's time to interview, right?
Yeah, that's right.
You just mentioned about Moses. Did he support the project or not?
Did he support the project? In what way?
Yeah.
Well, he supported it by cutting through some... The question was about Robert Moses and did he support the project. He supported it by cutting through some red tape. He was not a great admirer